on business and labor. We have three bills set up for today. Senate Bill 215, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 215.
Senate Bill 215 eliminates various set-asides for Oregon Business Development Fund, including set-asides for emerging small businesses and loans under $50,000. It eliminates requirement that cities or counties pass resolution in support of Oregon Business Development Fund project. It eliminates county limit on loans from Oregon Business Development Fund. It increases the maximum loan amount from $500,000 to $1 million. Allows Economic and Community Development Department to make initial deposits and loan loss revenue accounts for capital access program. Eliminates statutory provision of insurance account for industrial development bonds. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay. Some testimony here, Mark. Please come up. Introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony, sir.
Right.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Houston. I manage business finance for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I'm here to support Senate Bill 215. Senate Bill 215 makes some modifications to the business finance programs operated at the department, making them easier to administer and providing more capability to work with banks and businesses and helping them create jobs in Oregon. The provisions of Senate Bill 215 are in three programs and six categories. And Mr. Chairman, I'll take your direction somewhat here because they are in the six areas. If the committee would like to discuss them one at a time, we could go that way, or I could go through the whole testimony and then we could come back to the individual provisions.
Why don't you just take them one at a time?
Okay.
That'll be good.
Well, let me give you an overview first. The four provisions for the Oregon Business Development Fund are, one, increases the maximum loan in the Oregon Business Development Fund to $1 million from $500,000. Eliminates various set-asides for the Oregon Business Development Fund, including set-asides for emerging small businesses and loans under $50,000. Eliminates the requirements that cities or counties pass a resolution in support of an Oregon Business Development Fund project. Eliminates the county limit on loans from the Oregon Business Development Fund. And then in another program, the Capital Access Program, it would allow the department to make initial deposits and loan loss reserve accounts for the Capital Access Program. And finally, in the Industrial Development Bond Program, we'll eliminate the statutory provisions of the insurance account for industrial development bonds. This is generally called the umbrella revenue bonds, an unused statutory structure for pooling small bonds. So, again, back to the first concept provision in the Oregon Business Development Fund, increasing the maximum loan amount from $1 million, to $1 million from $500,000. The Oregon Business Development Fund is a statewide revolving fund that is targeted at manufacturing, processing, high technology, and regionally significant tourism projects. The legislature established the fund in 1983. The Finance Committee for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission, a group that oversees the fund, is comprised of bankers and business people from across Oregon, and I've provided you a list of those members. The initial loan limit size was set in 1983 at $250,000. The loan limit was increased to $500,000 in 1997. The fund is designed to partner with banks and private lenders to fund companies that are growing and creating jobs. The fund is profitable. It pays for all staffing costs and loan losses and earns approximately 4% per year. The department has not received funding since 1995 from the legislature to recapitalize the fund. It has basically been a self-sustaining revolving loan fund. The department is recommending that the statutory limit on loans be increased to a maximum of $1 million. The higher limit will give the department more capability to work with small and medium-sized companies that need to finance larger, more expensive projects. The Finance Committee that oversees the program would adopt rules on how and when to make loans up to the maximum amount, of the loan limit. Because this program is based on economic development and job creation, and based on budget decisions in this biennium and next biennium, there may be additional resource allocations by the Department's Commission to the Oregon Business Development Fund to allow larger loans to be made. This concept was generated out of a strategic planning process that occurred during the interim to suggest concepts to provide an economic stimulus to Oregon. The Oregon Business Development Fund is an excellent job-producing program. The loan size increase would give us more capability to work with banks and businesses that are growing and creating jobs in Oregon.
Yeah, Mark, would it would cause a problem? You're going to increase it from 500 to a million. Under the 500,000, an accident of 250, and then 500,000. And since 95, you haven't had to recapitalize the fund. If you raise it to a million, you're going to have to recapitalize it, or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we likely will, and this would give us the ability to go up to that. If we would recommend as a department not to increase the amount if there are no funds available. So this would give us the opportunity, if you will, if there would be recapitalization that would occur. Obviously, with the funding issues in the state, that's a difficult proposition. That traded off with economic development benefits of the program, there may be some capability to recapitalize it, but without recapitalization, we would not recommend moving the limit up to $1 million. We would retain it at $500,000.
And where is this revolving loan fund? Clarify that. Where does that come from, the revolving loan fund?
Initially, there was some federal money, $2 million of federal money that was put in the fund, and then some lottery money, approximately $9 million of lottery money that was put into the fund. It has since grown to approximately $18 million in total value. So it is a revolving loan fund that continues to revolve the money that's paid back by companies participating in the program to new loans.
How many loans are out there now?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I don't have exactly, but I'm going to say about 350 have been totally made, and I'm going to estimate approximately 100 are outstanding.
Do we have any defaults on them?
Mr. Chairman, we do. This is obviously a somewhat higher risk loan program. It's what we call a subordinate loan program. We subordinate the state's interest to a senior lender. Our loan losses are approximately 5% in total. When we approve a loan, we put 5% of the loan amount into a loan loss reserve account that approximates what our losses are.
You said $18 million you've got in the fund right now.
Approximately, and approximately $3 million available to lend. A little less than that.
How would it work if you had to come to the legislature to recapitalize it? I mean, would you have to come to the legislature to recapitalize it? And then how would that process work?
Mr. Chairman, I think that question is still somewhat in flux. In the last legislative session, there was a community development fund that was established in which monies did flow to the Economic Development Commission that then reallocated monies to various programs as they saw the priority from the Economic Development Commission's perspective. There's still some possibility that monies will be allocated out of that fund this biennium, but I don't know the specifics of that. And then it's possible that same scenario could come out of this legislative session. But I think the budget process, both from the governor and from the legislature, is still in flux.
Any more questions along these?
Mr. Chair, yes. Let me make sure this we're talking about the loan fund and the Oregon Business Development Fund, right?
Correct.
And there's $18 million of funds, $3 million is currently available to be loaned.
Correct.
And what's the average interest rate for these loans?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, the rate, there's two different sub-programs, if you will. One rate is set at 1 point over Treasury rates for a similar maturity. That rate would be approximately 5% for a 10-year loan. And then we do have a lower rate in distressed areas that's 4% currently fixed for the term of the loan.
Follow up to that, Senator. Any further questions on this particular?
I'll wait for you, Senator. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. The second concept, again, this is related to the Oregon Business Development Fund. It would eliminate set-asides. The set-aside for loans to emerging small businesses and for loans under $50,000 has been in statute in the Oregon Business Development Fund since 1989. 15% of the amount available in the fund is set aside for loans to emerging small businesses. That's approximately $4.8 million. 17% of the amount of loan amount available in the fund is set aside for loans under $50,000. That's approximately $5.5 million, and this has been, again, since 1989. There's approximately $32 million has been available to lend in the Oregon Business Development Fund since that date. The department has loaned $4.3 million of the target $4.8 million to emerging small businesses. The department has loaned $3.6 million of the target $5.5 million in loans under $50,000. The Oregon Business Development Fund is a statewide revolving loan fund targeted to expanding traded sector businesses that are expanding and creating jobs. The fund has been successful in revolving its funds and making funds available for new projects. As a result, more than enough monies have been available to lend, even with the set-asides. With recent increases in activity, this may not be true in the future. The department has not received enough loan applications for loan under $50,000 to meet the set-aside requirement. Business borrowing needs are dictated by the market and their ability to service debt. As the cost of equipment, real estate, and construction increase, the demand for smaller loans decrease. We are seeing that occur. The set-aside for loans under $50,000 is becoming a potential issue related to the availability of monies to loan in the Oregon Business Development Fund. Several factors have converged to complicate this set-aside. The first is that the amount, $50,000, was set in statute in 1989. Inflation and the cost of doing business have made the limit more constraining over time. Also, the maximum amount of an individual Oregon Business Development Fund loan was increased from $250,000 to $500,000 in 1997, which makes meeting the set-aside objective more difficult. As a result, the department, without more funding, will soon have the balance of funds entirely set aside for loans under $50,000. In that case, we'll be forced to cease accepting applications for any loan of $50,000 in the relatively near future.
Any questions on this segment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Houston, I don't really see anything that tells me why you're setting aside so much money.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, that those set-asides were placed in statute by previous legislature, and they were set aside for two reasons in general. One, for loans under $50,000, and I think there was a perspective from the legislature that that there was an increased need for, if you will, or a gap in the capital markets for smaller loans to businesses. And so there was the reason for that set aside. The other reason, the other set aside is for emerging small businesses and distressed areas. This would be companies that are relatively new companies. And again, I think the legislature was looking at targeting the funds to those relatively new companies and seeing that that the capital availability would be more difficult for those companies.
Okay, and then the reason that you don't want to set aside so much is because it's hampering your ability to make the loans.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, correct. And we still have money available, so that there is money available, there is we do accept applications and have funded all the projects we can for those two set aside areas. But as in particular, the one that's giving us the most concern is for loans under $50,000. As that set aside increases and it's approximating $2 million in the amount set aside, it will soon be in a situation where we'll have the entire amount of the fund set aside for loans under $50,000. Again, you know, we are happy to work with and want to work with all companies in all size projects, but we're just seeing less demand, frankly, for loans under $50,000. We don't see that many applications for those size loans.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Mark, we talked this morning with Mr. Brantley about focus and strategy for the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. Just so I can clarify what I believe I see in your testimony here is that as we look to refocus government and use our dollars, you know, most wisely and where they're most effective, do you see this as we have arbitrary statutory requirements that we have put upon the department, which may or may not necessarily
correlate with the strategy for economic growth in Oregon, and that these removal of some of these obstacles, which are not necessarily market-driven, do you see that as giving you more flexibility to meet target economic goals?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's correct, and that would free up obviously money. And again, you know, our objective is not to not work with smaller projects, not work with emerging businesses, but take every application that comes along that's good job producing applications and make the loan if it's appropriate to do so.
Thanks, Senator.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to figure out where in this bill we're talking the $50,000 threshold is, and if you start with that, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I don't have the full statute in front of me, but Section 16 repeals 285B 153, 285B 374, and 285B 377, and I believe that is in one of those sections of the statute, but I don't have the full statute here in front of me.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Here, the bill on page 3, section 2, sub 6, that's where you're eliminating the entire subsection 6, and that's where the one that speaks to the 15% of money available for lending. And I guess I'm curious to know why you need that, because the way I was looking at it, there is a default in the tail end of that section. Says if you can't meet the applications of the subsection, it may, notwithstanding the limitations imposed by another section I haven't got to yet, but you know, make other loans available to service and retail businesses. So is that not a mechanism for that you can use part of that 15% money to go to other places?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, that there is that default provision. It has been used sparingly, and I think how the program operates is that we communicate to bankers and businesses across the state related to the major provisions of the program and who's eligible. For this provision to go into effect, there has to be money that isn't in that set-aside, or the set-aside goal has not been made, so it would take a significant communication process for us to communicate that there would be money available for what we call non-traded sector businesses. The reality is that it's not been used much, and we do have other programs that do fit retail and service businesses in our guarantee side that fill that gap more directly, and we're able to communicate to the bankers and businesses about eligibility much more directly.
Mr. Chair, isn't that the reason for wanting to eliminate this section, because you haven't used all those funds?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, and both of the sections were proposed to be eliminated. It is we have nearly met that goal as in I think we're approximately $500,000 short of meeting that goal. So as long as that we're close in meeting that goal, then you know we do not actively market that we can make loans to retail and service businesses. So the reality of the set aside is that it's mostly an internal department calculation rather than a marketing effort, if you will, on our part.
Mr. Chair, I guess the problem I'm having is that this section says that the funds have to be loaned to enterprises that are in distressed communities, and if we eliminate that requirement, then this I would assume this will free up that potential $4.8 million to be loaned anywhere, and I believe the distressed communities is where we should be targeting our work, not Washington County, for instance. But, for distressed communities is where we need economic development.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, there has been $4.8 million set aside in for emerging small businesses, and we've made $4.3 million of loans to emerging small businesses. So there's actually approximately $500,000 that we're looking at that's, if you will, that potentially could go to retail and service businesses in distressed areas. So it's a smaller number than the $4.8 million.
I recognize that, Mr. Chair, but if we eliminate this provision of the statute, there will be no requirements that any of this $4.8 million then has to go to distressed communities. Mm-hmm. And that's my concern. It's the $4.3 that's already been loaned that would, as that gets freed up in the future, as those loans are paid back, they no longer then have to target that money to distressed communities.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, and obviously part of our agenda is for loaning in distressed communities. One provision that is not part of this bill, that is part of the Oregon Business Development Fund, is that the department can make lower interest rate loans in distressed areas. And that has been, frankly, a much more effective way of moving monies into distressed areas than necessarily having a set aside for those distressed areas. And that has really been, from a business's perspective and from banker's perspective, a much more attractive economic development tool, if you will, to move money into that direction of distressed areas of the state. And this fund, and I'd be happy to provide the numbers for you when that provision went into effect. But it did increase volume in loans in distressed areas substantially by making the interest rate change in the fund.
Your concern is that there's no requirement then to make loans in distressed areas.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
But if this is taken out, there is no requirement to make loans?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, that would be correct. There would be no requirement, but again, we actively encourage loans in all parts of the state, in particular in distressed areas of the state. And as I mentioned, we do have that provision that allows us to make lower interest rate loans in distressed areas, which really does make a substantial impact on the number of loans that are made in those areas.
Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you done?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Houston, following up on that point, can you make more loans at the 4% rate than you could if you had this money set aside to make loans? And so therefore you'd serve more businesses?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, and I think that was the point I was trying to make, is that is really a more... it's a better economic development tool, if you will, to reprice the interest rate. It gets more activity than simply setting aside the money, which doesn't necessarily drive demand.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What is the rate of these loans?
Mm-hmm.
The ones in this section.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, the rates for... what I would call the regular Oregon Business Development Fund available to businesses across the state is set at 1 point over Treasury rates for a similar maturity. So we would look at the U.S. Treasury rate and set it 1 point higher than that. For a 10-year loan, that would be approximately 5% in today's market. For the targeted account, which is in distressed areas, the rate was set at 4 points below prime, which prime is now at 5.25, but with a floor put at 4%. So the floor has been in effect for some time given this interest rate environment. So we do make loans in distressed areas at 4%, and that has been an attractive feature for businesses.
Mr. Chair, with Senator Walker's questions and now this answer of my last question, I'm completely confused, because I was led to believe by the answer to Senator Walker's question that the loans made under this section is targeted to be removed. If the part that dedicates the funds to distressed areas was higher than 4%, but I think the answer I just got now was that those are 4% loans. So which is it? I mean, they're set aside for distressed areas, and they are 4% loans. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Breyer, just to be absolutely correct on this, it's set aside for emerging small businesses in distressed areas. So there is a finer distinction of what the set aside is for. It's for targeted areas of the state, high employment areas of the state, plus meeting the goal of that it be an emerging business in those areas.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Okay, so I think I've got that right in my own mind. That would bring me to the next question, and you'll have to help me run through all these statutory references in this bill and in this section of law. But on page 2, line 14, you are suggesting that we delete the definition of emerging small business. So how does that tie into all this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Breyer, and that because there would not be a set-aside for emerging small businesses under what's being proposed, that we would not need the definition for that in statute. And there are other provisions and other parts of the statute that do define that, but not within the we would eliminate that from the Oregon Business Development Fund.
Answer my questions.
Senator Walker?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay, Senator, anything else? All right. Thanks, Walker. These were being tough on you, aren't we? We're just asking all these questions.
There's a lot in this bill, Mr. Chairman, so
we just went through our session today where we had our sort of our mock thing where we ask a lot of questions. I think this is a carryover here. Nobody wants to make a mistake here.
I understand.
We did take one bill back from committee today, so we want to be extra careful.
Sure.
So please proceed.
Okay. The next would eliminate local government resolution of support for Oregon Business Development Fund loans. The requirement for local government, a city or county resolution of support, has been a statutory requirement for making a loan from the Oregon Business Development Fund since the program's inception. This extra level of government review is burdensome to the potential borrower and to the department, and in some cases it requires extra time to complete. The benefit of this review is not evident. Staff is not aware of any project not being approved locally. County commissions and city councils are often confused regarding the requirement. In particular, they're concerned that they may have some underwriting role or liability, which they do not. Several local governments have complained about extra staff time and paperwork from their end. The department doesn't believe these approvals are necessary.
I see nobody from the county wants to be here to make sure this requirement is there. Any questions, any problems on that?
That sounds like a good move to me.
There you go. Go to number 4.
Okay, number 4 would eliminate the county limit on loans from the Oregon Business Development Fund. The Oregon Business Development Fund statute requires not more than 20% of the fund's value be outstanding in any one county at any time. This requirement was put in statute to ensure that a single county would not receive a lion's share of loans. In the last biennium, the department placed a moratorium on Oregon Business Development Fund loans over $100,000 from Lane County based on this statutory provision.
Mm-hmm.
Although the volume of loans in Lane County has exceeded the 20% limit, the overall historical pattern has been closer to their appropriate share. Since the inception of the fund, Lane County businesses have received 11.3% of the total volume of loans made statewide. Lane County represents approximately 9.6% of the state's population. So while they have received somewhat more volume on a per capita basis, they are close to their appropriate loan share. Furthermore, with money available to lend, it's difficult to turn away good job-producing projects anywhere in the state.
Mr. Chair, does this requirement ever hamper a loan into some small counties, population-wise, small counties, specifically east of the mountain, the Chairman's District, for instance, where if they don't have the population base, whatever, equal 10% of the state or whatever, Weaver County, for instance, has about 1,500 people in it. Has it ever been a problem?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, no, this issue really, because it's talking about that the test is really on the total value of the fund in any one county, the real likely counties would be the metropolitan counties, Lane County, possibly Jackson County, and Deschutes County that could run up against this simply because they would have the volume of companies and businesses and projects that could potentially at one time exceed 20% of the loan value of the fund. Smaller counties this would not affect, other than if you stop making loans in a large county, then there would potentially, at least theoretically, be more monies available in the fund to those other counties.
And Mr. Chair, wouldn't those other counties be the more economically distressed counties of the state, the smaller counties that are probably needing these loans more than these large counties?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, and I think that, you know, we recognize that from the department also, this does give us more flexibility statewide. The aspect of the fund that I guess one provision, and I hopefully I was clear, is that we take a snapshot of the fund at any one time, and if we see a lot of volume, a lot of recent volume in one county like we did in Lane County, then it can move us over that threshold. But if you look at the total experience of the fund, we're not seeing any county that's getting more than what we would consider to be their fair share.
Mr. Chair, as being a legislator from Lane County, I do appreciate those funds coming into our county, and I think each county has peaks and valleys where they're in need of these funds, and if you are doing this assessment, I think that we're going to preserve that aspect of the program.
And Mr. Chairman, I would like to make one comment about Lane County and that we have made a number of loans outside of the metropolitan area of Eugene and Lane County and a number of the rural communities that have benefited from the program also.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. On that same topic, and I see exactly why you want that flexibility, and from my perspective, I think the more flexibility we have in changing how we operate economic development is important. However, I'm curious, in developing this portion of the revision of the statute, did you have any discussion about, I think the concerns that you would have from low population counties about this? And I can see why the statute being so narrowly written, you know, that at any one time you pop above that 20%, but the elimination of that totally might get some people trepidation that, you know, they'll never get there if a number of large projects are put over. And I was just wondering, did you have any discussion about just expanding the window? 20% over a five-year period or three-year period, so because obviously you could potentially, you know, loan out so much money that there's just not going to be any ability to recapture that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, we did have those internal discussions. Part of our experience and has been the historical experience of the fund is that we've had a good experience with this fund and have had monies available. And to the extent that any one county would even go over that amount hasn't, and we wouldn't anticipate that would limit us in making loans in other counties. It really just puts a limit on that one county, but doesn't bring more monies, if you will, to the other counties of the state, other than in a more theoretical case. That's been our history. I can't say that to be absolutely true in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, it's possible we may be scraping the bottom of the barrel, and that if we have to make those difficult choices of, you know, which loans to make where, if one county wasn't eligible, then that may make it eligible in another county. But so far, we've not been in that position. I would hope that we wouldn't be, but we have seen increased demand on the fund, so it's possible it could happen in the future. But it's unlikely.
Chair, the reason I bring that up, just, you know, playing devil's advocate here, is that I think one might argue that, your historical experience may reflect that because the statute has guided you that direction. And I'm just, just kind of thinking ahead to some folks who may, I agree with you, I think you need that flexibility, but also, since we're looking at overall statewide development, that could give some people cause for alarm that, that you could have such an increase of activity in one area, that, again, the fund itself could be difficult to bring that down and provide opportunities elsewhere. So I think that's a concern that some folks may have.
One more question. The statute, the original purpose of the statute was to ensure that a single county would not receive a lion's share, and if that's the concern that you're talking about, and, give us a little more comfort level how you feel the department is going to handle that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and again, there's no assurance that in the future we'll have continued availability of funding. We may run out in this account. I would hope not. Either through recapitalization or other means that we could get additional money into the funds, and that would be our initial hope, that this situation would never limit us in making loans anywhere, because we would have monies available. In the event that we do eliminate this and we would see a lot of projects coming in from one county, I guess theoretically it's possible that we could see that occur. Our marketing efforts are statewide. We try to get projects from all over the state. We have 12 regional offices that are developing projects. We're talking to bankers from across the state. Part of this is hoping that we can find good projects and good job producing projects from everywhere in the state. I honestly wouldn't see it being so concentrated in one county that this would be a problem, other than theoretically.
Other questions? Proceed, Mark.
This is a new program, the Capital Access Program. This would allow the department to make initial deposits in loan loss reserve accounts for the Oregon Capital Access Program. The department operates a program called the Oregon Capital Access Program that provides matching contributions to loan loss reserve accounts established in participating banks. To help bankers make an, quote, almost bankable loan, unquote, they can enroll a project in the Capital Access Program. The bank charges the customer a fee. That fee ranges from 3% to 7%. Which is matched by the department, and in distressed areas of the state is double matched by the department and placed into a loan loss reserve account at the participating bank. This loan loss reserve is a common reserve to all Capital Access Program loans made by that bank. In the event of a loan default, the bank can tap the loan the reserve accounts to cover their loan losses to the extent funds are in the reserve account. To encourage more banks to participate in the program, the department is recommending that we provide an initial deposit of $50,000 per bank to seed the reserve accounts. By doing so, lenders will not have to take the initial risk that an early loan will default with little money in the loan loss reserve. This has been an impediment to banks participating in the program. The department would contract with participating banks to ensure that banks will commit to market and administer the program once they have accepted the deposit. Capital Access Program has been a very successful program in helping small businesses gain access to bank-originated loans. To operate the program, it does take a commitment from the participating bank to do a volume of loans. Getting banks to make that administrative commitment and install the program is challenging in an environment where banks have many opportunities and responsibilities. This feature will provide some encouragement to make that commitment and then successfully do a volume of small business projects.
Yes.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask the question. You referred to banks often. Under the statute, are these capital investment programs for the money to be deposited, are credit unions allowed to participate in this program as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Musker, yes, they are. We have enrolled one and possibly two credit unions in the program, but they have not been active.
Any further questions on this? section. You're on to number six. Is that where we're at?
Yes, it is. And this is a different program, industrial development revenue bonds or pooled umbrella bonds. This feature is also known as. This would eliminate the statutory provision of the insurance account for industrial development bonds or these what are known as umbrella revenue bonds. This I would characterize as a housekeeping amendment that eliminates several statutory provisions for a pooled industrial development bond program called umbrella revenue bonds that was not successfully implemented. The concept to pool small business development smaller business development projects into one larger bond issue to save on costs is a good concept. However, the technical difficulties of managing and delivering an umbrella bond program, especially with changing federal rules governing the program, has made delivery of this program impractical. The department has not given up on the concept. We believe, based on discussions with bond counsel and financial advisors, that a pooled industrial development bond program would be feasible. We are currently examining several methods to accomplish this goal. However, the structure envisioned in statute to accomplish this goal is not workable, so we are recommending that it be deleted from the statutes. And with that, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer questions on that feature or other questions you may have.
Senator Metzger.
Well, just on the last point, because I think certainly the concept that was done with the pooling to allow others to have access to a market at a lower rate is good. You talked about you're working on a couple of other concepts, so if the particular legislative authority is not working, I certainly understand that, but I would be very curious as to what the particular concepts you're working on that would allow others to aggregate for bonds.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, and if I can, this gets into a lot of technical side of it, but the concept for the umbrella bond program was to place some resources of the state, including the Oregon Business Development Fund, to support the bond program, and by doing so, to help underwrite some of the risk, if you will, of pooling those bond issues together. That structure, because the state was somewhat at risk, really did cause complications in how the bond would be issued, and it didn't get us to the point of the goal of making it a rated, and what's called investment grade bond, something that would be triple B bond or above. So if you couldn't meet that hurdle, it put us in a position where it really added additional complexity to that structure. So we, in the mid-80s, eliminated that concept and went with a different concept of what's called a composite bond issue. And we were successful in issuing one bond under that structure, which is basically taking individual companies having their bank write a letter of credit to support the transaction, and then having a master letter of credit be over the entire bond issue and get a rating on that bond issue. And that was successful, and that was back when First Interstate was in the state, and we were successful in doing that. We believe that structure could again work. It is complicated and takes a lot of administrative work to get there, and we're exploring that in addition to potentially guaranteeing bonds under that structure. So that's where we're at currently. We do not see that it would take any additional statutory structure to do that. We have the statutory structure to be able to do that currently. What we're eliminating here doesn't limit our capabilities. It just takes out some statutory structure that really just didn't work under that arrangement.
Okay, well, thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. We have a lot of questions today. Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 215?
Hey, Mr. Chair. Yes. Before Mr. Houston leaves, could I make an observation?
Sure.
This has come to us on four sheets of paper. You could have done it on two if you do back-to-back. And since you are the Department of Economic Development, please save your money and do that in the future.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Both of us used to make a living selling wood with paper.
Yes.
I would object to that proposal.
Well, we have the public
hearing. Sort of like a rubber stamp question this morning on the floor.
Well, we have still the public hearing. My sense is this is a very complicated bill. What I'd like to do is just sort of think about it a little bit, not move it to a work session today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would agree with that. And if the issue in the reserve accounts, the 15% reserve to distressed communities, is the fact that it's those monies are targeted toward emerging small business enterprises. If that's the issue that is concerned, because we can't find emerging small businesses, and I would agree that it's important to keep existing businesses as well as find new businesses. Both are important, and it's a lot less time consuming, a lot easier, a lot cheaper to keep existing businesses than it is to find new businesses. Rather than delete the section that reserves the 15%, which I cannot support, I would suggest maybe delete the references that require that 15% go to emerging small businesses in distressed communities. Keep the requirement that 15% go to distressed communities, but maybe delete the requirement that it go to emerging small businesses. That would be one way to delete some of my concerns of the bill. Another, I'm very concerned about the 20%. You know, limit being removed. I think that just going to force all the activity into the metropolitan areas, which what this has been designed to do is to spread the monies out throughout the state. And even though my district is Clackamas, Marion, and Lynn counties, you know, some of the most populous districts, the communities I have in these counties are in the distressed areas of the state. So.
Okay, good. Any response to that, Mark? I mean, it looks like there's some concerns, so we ought to be working together here to see if we can address those things.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I'd be happy to have further discussions with the committee or committee members on those issues and either, you know, address your concerns or look at alternatives.
Okay. Good with that?
Yeah, I'd like to.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 215. And not go into a work session, and we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 233. Mr.
Johnson,
sir.
Senate Bill 233 allows unemployment insurers to terminate their liability by providing 30-day termination notices to employers, authorizes employment director to specify conditions upon which money, government securities, or other types of security is permitted to demonstrate ability to meet financial obligations, eliminates claim closure penalty, and requirement for Oregon Attorney General to review claims, establishes identical appeal periods for workers and employers. No revenue impact, and no fiscal statement at this time.
Okay. We have a couple of witnesses. Where's Jerry? Jerry Manahan. Okay. Welcome, Jerry. Put your name right here. Please state your name for the record and commence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jerry Manahan. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to ask your support for Senate Bill 233. This bill is brought forth by the department, and I'm going to try to cover. The bill has several technical components to it, so I'm going to try to break it into three primary areas. The first area addresses employer coverage. Employers in this state are required to have workers' compensation coverage. And one method of processing that is through private insurance. When they obtain private insurance, a guaranteed contract is filed with the director. That provides us assurance that those employees are covered by the employer. Our current process requires a paper guarantee contract to come from the insurance company when an employer has their insurance. What we're trying to do is make our system a little more efficient by going through electronic transmission of data. So this one of the things this bill does, it tries to allow insurance companies to file these guarantee contracts with the director electronically. And to accomplish that, we wanted to clarify the statute that an electronic transmission would establish a guarantee contract with the director. We process about 85,000 coverages for employers, and about 25,000 of those are processed each year through endorsements or renewal. So this will save an awful lot of paper having to go through the process.
That'll make Senator Walker. Yeah. Hmm? That'll make Senator Walker. Save that paper.
Save on paper.
One of the changes that would occur, however, would change a 30-day liability period, possibly for some insurance companies. What an insurance company has 30 days minimum time to notify an employer of termination of a policy. When they send that notice to the employer, they also send a copy to the director. Under the current law, the director holds that insurer liable for 30 days after the date within which we received the copy of that termination notice. This bill, what it would do, would establish that 30 days from the date that was mailed to the employer so that we would end that 30 days. There would not be an unintended liability that would go to an insurance company for failure to get that notice to us in time.
I say that again with it. What was the time?
Okay, basically, insurance companies have 30 days, Mr. Chair, to file a notice of termination of a guarantee contract with the employer, so the employer has adequate time to get new insurance. And by doing this electronically, this would allow that 30 days to start the date that was mailed to the employer. So we'll be tracking the mailing dates of those notices that go to the employer to establish that 30-day period.
And you're talking about mailing dates or sending dates? What?
It would be the mailing date would be the date they would put it in the mail and send it to the employer.
Okay. But there's electronic notice that was prior to that. Is that what you mean? I'm kind of a little confused there.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Typically, when an insurance company is terminating their coverage with an employer, they would generally give them 30 to 60 days or more advance notice of termination of their policy. And they'll send that notice to the employer. And at the same time, they should be sending that notice to the director. When we receive that notice of termination, that's when we would check the end liability date for the policy and for the insurer. Today, if that comes in late, say, for example, they sent the notice to the employer on June 1st, but they failed and didn't send it to the director until August 1st, we would still hold that insurer liable for 30 days from the date within which we received that notice, even though their policy may have expired with the employer on July 1st. So there's an unintended period of liability that the carrier would have today. And with this, by going electronically, this would allow us to be in synchronized with the insurers when they actually send those notices to the employers.
I guess I'm just confused. Are electronic transmission and actually mailing? I mean, are you considering electronic the same as mailing then?
Mr. Chair, the electronic would be the process in which the data is transmitted to the director. The employers would still be receiving their same notices under this bill as they are today.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, another component of the Senate Bill 233 is dealing with the administration of non-complying employer activities. When an employee or a worker files a claim, and if there is no insurance with the employer, oftentimes there's a dispute over whether or not the worker is subject and whether or not the employer is obligated to have insurance. When that occurs, if there's one worker and another party, say a person is working for another party, we take a look at the case, and if we determine that the worker is not subject to the Workers' Compensation Act, for example, maybe it's an independent contractor who would not otherwise be subject, we issue what's called a non-subjectivity determination, telling the party that they're not subject, and they have 30 days from the date we mail that determination to file an appeal to that decision. Similarly, in that situation, if we find that there is an employment relationship and the employer is non-complying, then we send a notice to the employer of non-compliance, and they have 60 days from the date which they receive our notice to appeal that determination. Senate Bill 233 would change that, so the appeal period for both parties would be 60 days from the date within which we mail the notice to the parties. What happens occasionally is, especially involving the non-complying employer, they will elect not to pick up their certified mail. And we cannot provide service or go after collection activities with the non-complying employer until such time as we can finally track them down and prove the service at that point. And occasionally employers will be declared non-complying. They'll be gone for long periods of time. Then they'll show up at a later date. under this current status, for those people who are evading their service of the order, we will be able to still serve them at a later date and go for collection activities. Another component addressing situations when there's a non-complying employer is that when there is a claim and is processed by an assigned claims agent, which we would then pay the benefits to the worker, the statutes last session were changed, which allowed our assigned claims agent to utilize their own attorneys. But those attorneys would have to be Special Assistant Attorney General, which means the Attorney General's office has to oversee the activities of those attorneys. We've been working with the Department of Justice as well as our assigned claims agent, and they feel this is a layer of oversight that's not necessary. The assigned claims agent typically used attorneys who are well versed in workers' compensation, so this is basically a cost savings. They don't feel it's a necessary activity. The third area addressing the non-complying employer administration is dealing with what's called a closure penalty. When we find an employer to be non-complying, on the front end of this non-compliance, we issue a civil penalty. And that penalty today is up to 200% of the amount of premium that employer would have paid had they been insured. After that occurs, once the claim is processed, it gets to a point where they close the claim. But that is basically the worker's medically stationary and they determine the worker's benefits. When that occurs, that employer is levied an additional penalty at the end of the claim. We call that a closure claim penalty. The amount of closure penalties we issued last year was about $58,000. The front-end penalties we issued last year was over $8 million. This is a very small percentage of penalties we levy. And in addition to that, the people that we levy these against who actually have ability to pay are typically the employers who have since found coverage, they have worked with the agency paying their debt. So we feel this penalty does no longer serve its purpose as it did early in the early 80s. It was more common penalty then, but nowadays it doesn't have any efficiency for the agency's regulatory activities. The third area I'd like to talk about today is addressing self-insurance. Employers in Oregon are allowed to self-insure. And when they do that, one thing they are required to do is to provide a deposit through a surety or other form with the agency to prove that in case something happened to an injured worker, there would be enough money to pay all claims costs. Currently, the department receives direct deposits through cash, government securities, or other forms of surety. We've found that cash government securities are not protected in case of bankruptcy. The bankruptcy court can actually seize attachment to cash and government securities. So what we'd like to do with this Senate Bill 233 is to allow the director through rule hearing process establish the types of surety that are appropriate for the self-insured, but eliminate the requirement for the director to receive cash or government securities. And basically, I say this would trying to protect the fund through this. We've been working with the Self-Insurer Association with this concept. And another component of the self-insurance piece is dealing with what we call joint and several liability. Currently, a parent company, for example, can self-insure. And if they bring subsidiary companies under their self-insurance plan, the parent company is held liable for all liabilities. What we would like to have done through Senate Bill 233 is to ensure that all entities who are included in one self-insurance plan have joint and several liabilities for all the actions that occur during that period of self-insurance. This would be an example similar to like an Enron situation where if they had subsidiary companies, we could hold the subsidiaries equally as liable as the parent company.
Okay, very good. Questions? Senator Byer.
Yes, Mr. Chair, two questions. First, is this bill been through the MLAT process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, on Friday we did take this before Management Labor Advisory Committee. We received their approval. One thing I would, in the conversations that we had with them, though, there is a concern over the applicability regarding, for example, when the change in the securities would go into effect. For example, we have many self-insureds today who have government securities with maturity dates that are into the future. And we want to make sure there's assurance that we're not going to disadvantage any of those self-insureds who already have that form of deposit. So one of the areas that we'd like to have done with this bill possibly would be to add an applicability section to assure all the self-insureds in that circumstance that this would only apply to securities that are posted or deposited on or after the effective date of this act, so that when they replace their securities or they added new securities to for their deposits, that they would then have to use a different form of surety. Many of them, for example, would like to be able to post letters of credit rather than other forms of security. This would allow more options for the self-insureds. The second component of that would be the joint and several liability. They also feel this should apply to all self-insurance plans.
Okay. One other question, Mr. Chair. Section 7 of the bill, pages 8 and 9. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this the same section? It would be sub section 4, sub E, sub C. Isn't that the same section that we amended in a bill that was passed the Senate last week dealing with temporary rules when the director adopts workers' disability claims?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the bill I believe that you're referring to is Senate Bill 234, which intended to change the law so that the Management Labor Advisory Committee would no longer have to review temporary disability rating standards that are filed on individual claims.
Okay, so this is the same section. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe it is. I'd have to look through here real closely to make sure it is the same section, but I believe it does fall under the same general tenet.
But, Mr. Chair, my concern and suggestion is this bill is going to be amended anyway, that there's going to be a conforming amendment to make sure that by passing this bill at a later date, if that Senate Bill 234, I think, does pass, you would have to then, if this bill passes without conforming amendments, you would then reverse that bill that passed previously. So just needs to be checked to make sure that this section, by either combine the two bills and the changes into a single bill, or make sure they're conforming amendments to make sure we don't undo what we're trying to do.
Any further questions? We have another witness. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
J.L. Wilson, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, members. Chair Nelson, members, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, director of NFIB Oregon, but more importantly, as it pertains to Senate Bill 233, co-chair of MLAC, and I wanted to confirm for the record that MLAC did endorse the proposal unanimously. None of the changes are earth-shaking. They're all technical in nature. From a employer's point of view, we certainly like the fact that our employers aren't hung out to dry if an insurer doesn't file the required guaranteed contract with the comp department. And, from a labor point of view, I'm sure they appreciate that a self-insured subsidiary can't absolve their liabilities for a workers' comp claim should something happen, and as Jerry brought up, the PGE Enron debacle. So, a little mix of both. We easily agreed to all provisions.
As Senator Beyer's point, at 234 and 233, was there any discussion of that?
Thank you, Chair Nelson. I'm not sure of the applicability. 234, I basically refer to it as the NFIB Mail Reduction Act. I don't have to see all those temporary rules across my desk anymore, most of which I didn't understand anyway. But you know, I'm really not sure that there's too much applicability.
Any other questions?
Thanks.
Thank you. But you still have some concern that we're not conforming that, you know, the two statutes, and since you're, I think we better look at that before we...
Well, Mr. Chair, I thought I heard say they want an amendment anyway to make sure or clarification in the process.
Okay.
And so if they're making amendments, then they want to look, make sure that the two statutes, the two changes don't conflict.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sure maybe we can ask when they do the amendment to have the drafter of legislative council review any non-conforming things. I imagine they drafted 234 also to make sure that Senator Byer says we're not just kind of undoing the previous one.
It's good. Yeah. Any further comment? Any further witnesses? There was a proposed amendment or potential amendment, and then Senator Byer is concerned about some conforming language with Senate Bill 234, and so we'll, and Jerry's agreed that they'll look at that and they'll get it back to us, and we'll close the public hearing and not go into work session.
Well, I just had a quick comment before you close that out. Colleagues, I just want you to realize that the department gives people 30 days notice when they terminate their, or at least companies can give 30 days notice when they terminate their coverage. And the state of Oregon gave the medically needy and all of those other citizens 10 days notice, which I think is inappropriate, and I have a bill to address that. So.
Well, very good. Well, no further comment on Senate Bill 233. We will close the public hearing, not go into a work session on that, and take care of those other issues that are involved. And we have one more bill here. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 237. Mr. Dawson, sir.
Senate Bill 237 increases bond amounts for certain nonprofit organizations who elect to be reimbursing employers. Excludes nonprofits of under $100,000. No revenue impact, no fiscal statements issued at this point. This was heard on February 3rd. The committee had some questions, and I believe someone has returned to respond to some of those questions.
Okay, Renee.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Renee Bryant. I'm manager of UI Tax for the Employment Department. And I believe the way we left this last time was that the members of the committee were waiting on the fiscal impact statement, hadn't been completed at the time. And that has, I believe, been delivered to everyone.
I've not received it.
You did not receive it?
Have not received it.
Not received it.
If I may, our legislative coordinator, Tamara Brickman, just dropped by LFO, and they gave her this one, so if you'd like to share this with the committee.
Sure, yeah. How long will it take to get some quick copies of that made? How long will it take to make some copies of that? Why don't you go do that, and we'll just stand at ease for a couple minutes here. If there's something you want to talk about, anything else?
I'll just wait for the committee's pleasure.
Okay. Everybody has a copy of the fiscal analysis. It's actually going to increase revenues, is that?
Chairman Nelson, yeah. Members of the committee, what this will allow us to do is to collect additional monies for the unemployment insurance trust fund that we're currently not collecting based upon the bond default rate and employers who are unable to cover the difference. We're estimating about $180,000 a year in addition will go to the unemployment insurance trust fund.
Mr. Chair, that was a fiscal worth waiting for.
Well, Mr. Chair, who's going to be paying the additional money?
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear the question.
And who's going to be paying the additional $180,000 a year?
That will come from the nonprofit employers.
That doesn't include, I mean, the state government is a reimbursing employer. Does that include state government or schools?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, state government does not have to post a bond, and currently all state government has to pay on a reimbursing basis for unemployment insurance benefits paid.
So, I got one more question.
Yes, Mr.
The nonprofit employer
i.e. Garten Foundation, are they going to be required to put more money in the trust fund through a bond situation? So is it, in effect, raising their rates?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, what this bill will do is for employers currently who have payroll of less than $100,000 a year, post a 2% bond to cover the eventuality that they don't have enough money to reimburse the state for claims paid. Those who have $100,000 or more are required to post a lesser amount of bond. So all this is going to do is that for those employers, we will require an increased bond level and increase our level of security.
So replace it with a 5.2% bond, or I just have to sort of rejuvenate our memory here. Is that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It will make the rate the same for all nonprofit employers.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have my notes from our meeting on the 3rd of February about this, and the answer that was given was that it would build uniformity and equity in the bond structure, and you did ask the question at that time if people would be paying more money, and the answer was no, taxes are the same. And is that true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, that's true. The taxes will remain exactly the same. It's just the level of security that will be increased.
But, Mr. Chair, that is in effect. And if your bond rate goes, or your bond amount goes up, you have to pay more for it.
There is an additional $180,000 a year.
Yeah.
There is actually an extra $180,000 a year that's going to be coming out of nonprofits into this fund. It's not there now. Is that right?
Chairman Nelson, we anticipate, yes, that we will be able to collect additional funds that should be secured by the bond of up to $180,000 a year. So the nonprofits will be paying for the bond, but we're anticipating that these increased revenues will come from the bond surety.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chair? Yes.
I apologize. We're probably replowing the same ground, but I just don't recall this. Is there a problem that has been brought this change forward? I mean, is there some nonprofits who are not covering their own costs, and that's why we need this change?
Mr. Chair, Senator DeBar, that's correct. What we have found is that there have been a number of situations in which a nonprofit employer will, for various and sundry reasons, have substantial amounts of benefits owed back to the UI Trust Fund. The bond is insufficient to cover those benefits for one reason or another. About 10 to 20 a year will actually go out of business or default on their bonds, and we're not able to make up the difference in collecting from the business itself.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Messer.
Just curious on the, as you have evaluated those that were unable to, the bond was unable to provide for, in terms of the size of the nonprofit, did you break that down and see where the biggest failures are?
Chairman Nelson, Senator Messer, no, I apologize. We have not done that. We don't have the means of, or we haven't had the means of determining that whether or not it's the smaller ones or the larger ones.
Anything else? Any other concerns with this bill? Anything else that we need to talk about?
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. I think that taxpayers are left holding the bag. When the bond doesn't cover the amount, it's appropriate that we increase the bond, especially since it has been increased in over 27 years. It's a long time.
But I would ask, I have no problem with it, Senator, but I'd like to have the answer to that question because in terms of where the failure to meet the requirements have been from, I mean, I would assume you'd be able to have that data there. Because you said there are 18 to 20 or whatever, so it's not like we're talking thousands here. I'd just be curious to see what level of capitalization of these nonprofits are the ones that you've had the most difficulty with. If, in fact, you know, it's not across the spectrum, I would just be curious to have the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Messer, if we can get that information for you, we'll do so very promptly.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yes,
and that's a very important thing because currently the way I read the data that was given out, if you have less than $100,000, you're already at 2%. So if those are the ones that are all defaulting, and it's the fact that if the 2% is not enough to cover that area, this bill will not, in fact, do any good. If it's because all it's doing is raising the amount of bond for the larger employers of these nonprofits. So that's very important data that Senator Metzger is asking for, because you know, you have to know what sector is it that's defaulting.
So what's your comfort level on this?
Well, my comfort level is okay with it, because there's a lot in the process, but I would like to have the answer to that question. I have no problem, Mr. Chair, if you want to move forward with it, but I would, before we go to the floor, I'd like to have to know what that answer is.
We're not in any hurry to move anything to the floor. That's, like, we need to be comfortable about all this.
Well, if there's no particular rush on the building, Mr. Chair, I'd like to see if we can get that answer first, because that could provide some discomfort to some of our members. If in fact, I'm being hypothetical here, as Senator Byers pointed out, let's say that 80% of these are defaulted for people 100,000 or less. Well, they're now going to be subsidized by the larger ones who may have not much default at all. Or if it's vice versa, then all the more reason that we need to have a more equitable percent structure, because they're the ones that are being subsidized by the other ones. If it's across the board, then that's a whole different story. But if it happens to be weighted one way or the other, that may make an impact on whether in fact going to a 2% level is conformity or basically subsidization of another layer of the group.
Respond to that, Renee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I'm not sure that if those employers with a payroll of more than $100,000, if getting if the higher rate for bonding will be subsidizing other employers, it will mean that if one of those employers has a liability to the trust fund that it can't meet, that the trust fund's needs will more significantly be covered. Therefore, there will be less liability spread to other employers, distributed among the other employers. So I'm not sure, maybe it's a communications issue, that I'm understanding that you believe that if those employers above $100,000 have the 2% rate, that will be subsidizing other employers.
Well, my only point there, Senator Nelson, may make it more clear, is that if those with the smaller payroll have the greater defaults, depending on what the debt that is owed, and that then in sum the current system is not enough to meet all those obligations, that if we're not changing the rate for those with payroll 100,000 or less. Therefore, the increased payments to those defaults would obviously be paid essentially by those with payroll greater than 100,000. I just think it's very interesting to see what that breakdown is. Now, certainly if we've had a couple of major defaults in the high employment areas, then the converse would be true, that those in the 100 to 499 or 500 to 900 would be subsidizing those. I just think that's pertinent information to see where we are in that, to see if, in fact, we do have a balanced system. And I just think that's an important question to have answered.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, we will make our best effort to get that information. I can't promise you that we have it recorded, but we will dig everywhere to try to find it.
Okay. Close the public hearing and not go into work session until you get some information, just get a little more.
Thank you.
Just trying to get more information.
Fine.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 237. I think that's all the business we have before the committee. I was trying to think of some way. We had a committee chair meeting today, and I was trying to think of anything I should pass on to you. I don't think so. Well, there is one thing, is that President and the President Pro Tem asked that we consider, at the end of each meeting to make, at the end of each public hearing, to ask if there's more testimony so we have more input from people coming out there. But if we had a controversial issue, that we might have to be a little bit careful, because we might be here for 7 hours trying to get testimony. I guess they had a situation in the House where there were some people that were not really just invited testimony, and they had some issues over getting people to testify. So they just, so they wanted to leave it very flexible within the committee, but if you have some thoughts on that, I'd be willing to entertain.
Mr. Chair, is that invited testimony on any subject?
Well,
that's relevant to this committee?
Well,
rather than on a bill?
Just on a bill. I think they were talking specifically.
Okay.
And I can't remember the situation in the House. It was on health bill or something. And some folks were not able to testify, and they felt like that was not a good situation, that we should try and resolve those problems if we could. So that's it. I will declare the Senate Committee on Business Labor closed until we meet on Wednesday. Well, for 3 days.